Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Boris Karpa with New Books in Military History, and today we have with us Joseph Tarkowski, who is an unusual author for us in several ways. First of all, a lot of our authors come from the world of military history. Joseph Tarkowski is actually not a full-time historian. He is a restaurant consultant, and he's written a fascinating book, 40 Thieves on Saipan, the elite Marine scout snipers in one of World War II's bloodiest battles. And not only is it an unusual book, it's a book with an unusual story. I often ask writers how they've come to write the book, but in this case, it's a really fascinating story. The story of this book is a book in and of itself, really. It's a Hollywood story, I think. So, Joseph, can you tell us about your book and how you've come to write it?
Certainly. It all began with a eulogy that was delivered at my father's funeral. I always knew he was a colonel in the Marine Corps, and that was evident from all of the correspondence that he would get and the reunions that he would go to. But that was about it. He never spoke of World War II, and if the topic ever came up, he'd quickly avoid the subject. So at his funeral, many men got up to speak about his tenure as mayor and other things, his youngest brother. But one man got up and delivered a different sort of eulogy about the first time that he met Frank Tarkowski. And that was in 1955 at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And Dad was there on the GI Bill, and this kid was in Naval ROTC. And every time he'd go to the Naval ROTC meetings, there'd always be this Marine sergeant there who was very stoic in his dress blues, every inch a Marine. And if he had occasion to say this fellow's name, he'd just bark it out. But one day he sees this surly Marine sergeant talking to Frank, and they're joking and laughing. And the guy thought it was strange at first until he saw it happening a couple more times. And he finally went up to the sergeant and said, "Excuse me, but how do you know Frank Tarkowski?" And he said, "That's Lieutenant Tarkowski to you. And when you speak of him, do it with respect. He was our platoon leader on Saipan when a Japanese tank broke through our lines. We had no weapons to fight it with, and we all thought we were goners. The tank kept advancing. The fire from it was withering. And I thought I had seen my last day. Suddenly, out of the corner of my eye, this solitary figure runs into the field of fire, shoots a bazooka, disables the tank, and kills the crew inside. That was the lieutenant. He saved my life that day. He saved the life of every man in our platoon. So when you speak of him, do it with respect." So that was the first story I had ever heard about my father in World War II. And that prompted me that evening to search our last name and Saipan, and up popped this Marine Corps website with an article from a December 1944 issue of Leatherneck magazine. And it was titled Tarkowski's Terrors. legendary for exploits on Saipan. And the article was submitted by a fellow named Chris Tipton, who said, this was my father's platoon during World War II, and everything in the story is true, except they were never known as terrors. They were known as the 40 Thieves. And that started my piqued my curiosity even more. And I went into the garage and found my dad's footlocker that had been just sitting there for decades, and opened it up. And it was like a treasure trove of history, a time capsule of his.
And you were not allowed to open it as a kid.
Well, it never occurred to me, because it was something that he never talked about. And if he ever was looking into it, if I entered the room, he'd close it quickly. So it was something that it never piqued my interest to even look inside of it, let alone respect Dad's reticence of talking about the war, to go in it and start rooting around. I didn't want to open up old wounds for him in that regard. But like I said, it was a time capsule, and then the time ended in 1945 when he shipped back home. Every letter that he had ever sent to my mother was kept by her and then put into this footlocker. So I have all of his letters home from 1941, when they first met at Mike Lyman's and in Los Angeles, to when he returned home in September of 1945. Racetrack forms from Agua Caliente in Tijuana, where they went on dates, and his platoon rosters for Guadalcanal, Tarawa, and this scout sniper platoon. I found out that's what they were. And his handwritten notes on it of who was wounded, who was killed, who was sick. And one of the names on the roster stood out because it was the last name was Knuppel. And there was this fellow, Bill Knuppel, that we would visit all the time in Arizona. And all I ever knew is that they were Marine buddies and were stationed together on Iceland. But Bill Knuppel happened to be my dad's platoon sergeant on, you know, for this platoon. And unlike my dad, who never spoke of the war, Bill was a walking encyclopedia of everything Marine Corps from their time on Iceland through the Battle of Tinian. And it's funny now in retrospect, how if Bill ever wanted to talk to Dad about Saipan or Tinian or anything like that, Dad would always say, Bill, those days are over, and Bill would tacitly comply. And now I understand that even at the age of 80, they still had this relationship of sergeant to lieutenant, which I thought was kind of charming.
And then you began to also research, you know, I read your book, and one thing that stood out to me, that clearly you are also now very knowledgeable about the overall context of the events. You've clearly educated yourself in great detail about the Pacific Theater in general. So you've really done really historian's work here.
It was a lot of research. Besides locating initially I just located the men that were still alive, besides Bill Knuppel, and found three more of them who were alive, and just started driving around the countryside and from Wisconsin to Georgia, or to West Virginia, or to Montana, or to Arizona, over and over again. Maybe three times a year I'd be making these treks, because every time I'd talk to a man and get their version of the story, I'd share what I'd learn with the other fellows, and that kind of piqued more memories. And after doing this for about 4 years, I had assembled this huge jigsaw puzzle of stories that some were complete in and of themselves, like Knuppel's story about being on leave with Don Evans in Kona, or some stories, one man provided the beginning, another the middle, and the other the end. And it all kind of made sense. So then I got interested in putting it all together. And to help me do that, there's a website called Hyperwar, which is a Marine Corps site that deals with every battle in very detailed, in very great detail. I also went to the National Archives in Maryland and found Colonel Risley's journal. And Colonel Risley commanded the 6th Marine Regiment, and his scout sniper platoon were his brute squad, basically. They guarded the 6th Marine Regiment command post and went out on these covert missions. Another bit of information I found was from Peter Senich wrote a book called Scout Snipers of World War II in Korea. And he had photos in the book of fellows from Dad's platoon, but he doesn't know their names. I know their names. And he interviewed one of the fellows from the platoon, Otto Hebel. And it turns out that there were only two platoons like this that were deployed in the Pacific during World War II. So they were a very unique group. The first scout snipers famously secured the pier on Tarawa. And this scout sniper group, since there were no enemy lines to work behind on Tarawa, it was just a 72-hour bloodbath, Saipan was going to be a month-long grind of a battle, almost. And they were specifically trained to live and work behind enemy lines for days and weeks at a time, and draw maps and make maps from memory and scout locations to better guide naval and Marine Corps artillery onto targets and wreak havoc wherever they could. So they were very unique. In fact, Bill Knuppel once said that working behind enemy lines, firing a weapon would be your last option. So they were taught how to kill silently in ways that you can't even imagine. And Bob Smuts, another fellow from the platoon who lives in Georgia, mentioned that they learned the Biddle method of bayonet fighting and carried an array of knives with them that each had a singular purpose.
So, as I've said, I've recently, you know, finished my own dissertation, and I'm, because I know how difficult it is to actually do research, I'm really fascinated with the work you've done. And I always ask this question because I think it's an important question for readers. Can you tell us what was the biggest obstacle you encountered when you were working on your book, and how you, of course, you eventually overcame it? We now have a book, so can you tell us how you did that?
Well, time and distance. I have already intimated about traveling to see the men, because technology of the day would be alien to them, and I think they're going to be less willing to open up to a voice or an image on a screen as opposed to sitting with them in person and making it a very personal interaction with them. I grew to know these men like they were my second fathers. And so distance was difficult in that I would have to, you know, do all of this travel across country, and flying to Dahlonega, Georgia isn't an option, to Culloden, West Virginia isn't an option. So it was always a road trip. And time was also not on my side, because I wanted so much for these men who opened their wounds and shared their stories of sacrifice with me. I wanted them to share in its release when it came to fruition. So time of trying to make it into a saleable product for them. Unfortunately, Bill Knuppel passed away in 2014, but Bob Smuts was the next to go, but he at least knew that we had signed with a publisher. So he knew when he passed away. And then Roscoe Mullins and in Montana, Roscoe Mullins in West Virginia and Marvin Strombo in Montana were alive to, you know, hold the book in their hands and read it. And turns out that Marvin Strombo and Roscoe Mullins, the last two surviving members of the platoon, were best buddies from boot camp through Tinian. And even on to when, after the war, they were a police force on and in Japan for a few months. And Roscoe sent an autographed copy Marvin sent an autographed copy to Roscoe, saying, "To my fellow thief, you know, Roscoe, you know, love Marvin," which I thought was pretty touching for these old guys to be able to reunite after not seeing each other for decades.
Which brings me to one of the, I think, things which make your book so easy to connect with, that although there's a lot of research in it and there's a lot of facts, there's a lot of knowledge, which, for example, I did not know many of the things about the Pacific Theater, which I've learned from this book, but there's also a lot of detail about the conversations which people had, sometimes even the emotions which they felt. So it's almost like a novel, but, and I understand that a lot of this is from people's actual memories and what they've written down and or what they have told you, but are there any points where you would have had to fill the gaps? You know, some historical books do this, even some nonfiction books do this. I'm not saying that it is in some way fake. I'm explicitly not saying that, but are there any points where you've had to fill the gap, so to speak, with your imagination, with your instinct of what may have been said or what a person may have felt?
Right. One of the first pieces of advice I got when I submitted the first oral history version in 2015 was to write it as a narrative, that oral histories don't sell, write it as a narrative. And I found that very hard to do because I was so wrapped with the words of the men and how they described their feelings and what went on and their relationships with their comrades and those who were killed. And it was very hard for me to wrap myself around how to do that. But then finally, I came to understand that I could convert their words into narrative and use, you know, phrases that they might write home in their letter or phrases out of diaries and how that would become dialogue. But a lot of these guys remembered stories in dialogue, specifically Knuppel, when they encouraged one of the fellows, Don Evans, was a corporal in the platoon, and he was from Kansas City. And he had two friends in the Army who were stationed at Schofield Barracks. And the 40 Thieves made port in Honolulu, where Schofield Barracks is located. And while they had a little leave there, they went to visit these two Army buddies, and they end up getting drunk and convinced the two Army buddies to go AWOL with them and join the Marines for the invasion of Saipan. So the whole scene in the bar of encouraging them back and forth, that's all Knuppel. Don said, then Arello said, then Dooley said, and I said. But other situations, we had to you know, put flesh on the bones of their story. So there were some times that we had to, you know, create create a storyline to help it flow from, you know, beginning to end.
There are different sorts of readers in which this show is for, and a lot of them are military historians or people who read military history as history, but we also have some military theory people who try and study history as what they can apply for their service today, or what can be applied. Reading your book, it's clear that your father, Frank Tarkovsky, he had an instinctual leadership quality to him. He was, you know, sometimes people say, a leader of men, yes? He was respected by his men in an instinctual manner, which was not rank alone. I've served in the armed forces myself. I know that sometimes people have a rank and they are not respected. And some people are very deeply respected, like clearly your father was. So do you think that there are lessons which we can draw from his leadership, lessons which a modern reader could apply, maybe in their military service, maybe even in the management. There are many people who are trying to apply military leadership lessons to civilian life. Do you think there are lessons from your father's record which we could learn from?
Oh, sure. The thing that the men said most and what was most respected about my dad was Bill Knuppelity said he had command presence. You just knew you damn well better obey him because that's how he carried himself. And other men appreciated that the fact that Dad was a Mustang, and that's you know, rising up from a buck private into being an officer. And that's it's not rare, but it doesn't happen all the time that you rise up through the ranks like that. And the men appreciated it because he knew what it was like to be a private, as opposed to as Roscoe Mullins said, some fresh silver spoon fed dandy lieutenant that didn't know anything. So the guys really liked that a lot. And also it was, so my dad was never ask anyone to do anything that you wouldn't do yourself. So his men appreciated that too. And it turned out that, you know, Dad became mayor of our city in Sturgeon Bay and then had some unsuccessful runs for state office. He was a very good leader, progressive in our city. He invested in education. He got a new school built, started waterfront development, was part of a new hospital being built in our city. So he did quite a bit and led quite effectively. And knew how to get along with, I think that's the thing in the military that everyone can learn from, is how to get along with people that have different viewpoints than you have and how to get things done. Certainly would like to see a little bit more of that today. I was interviewed by someone in DC who said you could, the leaders, political leaders could learn a lot from the military as far as integration and how to work together to achieve a common goal.
Which is also interesting that clearly your father had, he had a civic spirit in him. He continued giving back to the community long after his military service had ended.
Correct. Yeah, he was, after he was mayor, he was also postmaster, and then when he retired, he was still active in the community quite a bit.
And one thing which fascinated me from my perspective as a historian, and it comes up a lot in your book, when we talk about the, of course, the 40 thieves, it's in the name, there were people with a degree of discipline problems.
to say the least.
The actual thievery is not the most unusual. It goes on even today. I've seen people do things in my own service which were somewhere between criminal drama and comedy. But the thing which fascinates me is that clearly, when even starting with Sir Frank Tchaikovsky selecting the men, when he says, when two people fight and one of them ends up in the infirmary and one of them ends up in the brig, I want the man who won the brig. Clearly, he's not very concerned with the formal legal side of military selection, where today military forces have a great emphasis on formalities, and if there is this black mark on your record, then we cannot take you into the special unit, to this particular service. And clearly, Frank Tchaikovsky bypassed that very effectively, to great success. And do you think that this is just because it was a different time, or is this a kind of lesson which we can or should learn from?
Well, there's a lot of different facets to this. One was all of these guys grew up during the Great Depression, where they had to learn to do without, and they had to probably steal to feed families or to, you know, repair machinery, or they had skills in, you know, that they learned growing up as children on how to survive in during the Great Depression. So that made them a little bit more resourceful than other generations. The other thing was that in the Marine Corps and during World War II, it was generally a phrase that you weren't considered a good Marine until you've been in the brig, you know, once or twice. So it wasn't necessarily a black mark at that time to have been thrown in the brig. And the Marines of World War II in general were notorious thieves because they were the poorest equipped branch of service and had to do all of the heavy lifting on Guadalcanal and Tarawa and Saipan and Tinian and all of those islands in the Pacific. In fact, when they first went into Guadalcanal, they were issued weapons, rations, and uniforms that were left over from World War I. And that's what they had to take on the seasoned Imperial Army that had been fighting for almost a decade in the Pacific, remnants of World War I. It wasn't until Tarawa then they started to get an M1 to replace their single-shot 1918 Springfield rifles that only had a six-cartridge magazine in it. So the Japanese would be counting off, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, knew you'd have to reload, and then they'd charge. So it was necessary for them to steal from the Army or the Navy, who were better equipped, just to increase their odds of victory against the Japanese, because they were a very cunning and a cunning enemy who would not quit. They would not surrender. So it made the war in the Pacific a much more cruel, brutal, and personal war for these guys, which is, you know, why when I began talking to Knuppel and Smuts and Strombo and Mullins and got to know them so much and how much they cared about all of these men who were in this 40-man unit, I didn't remember anybody from their platoons on Tarawa or Guadalcanal, but they remembered everyone from this unit. And Knuppel would say how he always remembers his, you know, buddies because who died because they never had a chance at life, and all of the Japanese boys that were just like them. And one of the things that I wanted to do with the book was to make sure that I brought back these fellows to life. And it's not just a book about war. It's a book about these 18, 19-year-old boys who went to war and, you know, wanting the readers to fall in love with them as their brother or son or husband or, you know, boyfriend or what have you. And many of the readers who adore the book happen to be women, which I don't necessarily find unusual, but they say it the battle scenes of it become so intense that they have to put it down, but then they have to pick it up and keep reading to find out what happens to all of these guys. So I'm very thankful that my co-author Cynthia Kroc and I were able to, you know, craft the book to succeed in that. And one of the things that my dad always said was a mantra of his that we don't do enough for veterans. And just to honor that sentiment, half the royalties we get from the book, I donate to organizations that do help our veterans, because I think it'd be a sad excuse of a son if I didn't honor his memory.
I'd like to come back to something you've mentioned just now, because it's interesting to me. You said that perhaps unusual for a book with such a subject. You said you have a substantial number of women readers. Do you think that the fact that you've written a lot, you've integrated into the book the relationships of some of these men with women back home, Do you think that this fact helps this book be more accessible, more, I don't like the phrase accessible here, but do you think it makes this book easier for women readers to sort of empathize with?
Well, there was a woman in Montana who bought the book mainly because of Marvin being from Montana. She found that interesting. And it was a nice comment that she said that I think it's a rare depiction of war that neither sugarcoats nor glorifies. And that's kind of it. You know, we're not some shoot 'em up, rah-rah Hollywood version. It's pretty, some people took exception to, thought it a vulgar book because these 18, 19-year-old boys, you know, were going to, you know, a place of prostitution on Hawaii. That was a Roscoe Mullins story, and some people took exception to that. It's, you know, these kids aren't choir boys. You don't get choir boys to go off to win a war. They're a bunch of rough and tumble kids that, you know, have been taken away from their homes. And I was just telling their story. And
let's go back to this because I find it kind of funny. It's because this is a book where people go to a foreign land and, you know, they kill people with bayonets. And there's a scene, there's a moment where prisoners of war are killed, yes. And but it offends readers that these same young men will go and they will go to a brothel in this kind of book.
Yeah, I'm like I said, I'm just telling their story. These are things that they did. You know, they were just kids. I think Bob Smuts in Georgia said the Marine Corps wanted 18-year-old boys because they just didn't have any sense. They'd go anywhere they were told. They would do anything they were told, and they just thought they were invincible. And these guys, you know, proved the point, except they learned that some of them weren't invisible. They all had friends in the platoon that died on Saipan. And, you know, nothing was more impactful for me than listening to Roscoe Mullins talk about Martin Dyer when you know, he was walked into an ambush and got killed on Saipan, about how quiet the night was and how still the evening, that you could hear the sound of Tipton tearing the sulfa packets, and you could hear the sound of the powder hitting the wounds and the gurgling and the bubbling of the blood. And the only other thing you could hear that night was Martin Dyer calling out for his mother, until you couldn't hear that anymore. Who can write that? These fellows lived that. And it just, you know, it makes me very happy that people are enjoying the book. And it can be a living legacy for not only the four fellows who contributed with their remembrances of sacrifice, but also for the, you know, to let the fellows who died on Saipan get a second shot at life for, you know, a brief few pages of book.
Now, I really think that this is a wonderful answer, and I'd like to thank you for this answer. And, you know, as we wrap up our show, there's always a question which we ask. It's not contractually required, but it's a question we always ask. You know, this is a show about books, and it's a show for readers. We're both writers and readers. And I'd like you to tell me, what are the books which you are reading right now, or perhaps there are some books which you would like to suggest to our audience. Where are you now in your book journey, if you will?
Sure. One thing that I've just reread is Minnesota 1918, and it's very relevant to today because it was also a time of, you know, a worldwide plague, the Spanish flu. the world was at war, and political strife was going on all in the state of Minnesota. And, you know, great fires swept across the state as well. So that's by Kurt Brown. I just finished rereading that. I've just started The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. And if people want to, you know, get a little bit better picture of you know, the background for The 40 Thieves, one book that I used almost as a Bible was Leon Uris's Battle Cry. Knuppel once said the guy in his Tarawa outfit wrote a book. I thought, oh, you know, he wrote a book, so what? No, but it was Leon Uris. Leon Uris and Knuppel were buddies. And Battle Cry is a fictional account of the war in the Pacific of the 6th Marine Regiment. And so everyone's name has changed. So Colonel Murray becomes High Pockets and Howland Mad Smith has a different name. But in the book, he writes of this notorious band of thieves in the 6th Marine Regiment. And one of their escapades was they stole an Army colonel's Jeep. So at first I'm reading it thinking it's all, you know, made up stuff. No, just, you know, but then I started to think, well, I should ask these guys, did you ever steal a Jeep? And I asked Marvin Strombo and he looked at me kind of strange and said, no. And Roscoe Mullins just laughed and hung his head. And I went to Bob Smuts and I said, Bob, did you guys ever steal an Army colonel's Jeep? And he said, no. And at that point I was deflated thinking that it was just all fiction. He said, it was an Army captain's Jeep and we beat the hell out of that thing.
Truth in television.
So that was fun. So I, you know, I like reading Leon Uris's Battle Cry. I use that almost as a Bible. That was another asset, as well as, you know, Colonel Risley's Daily Journal. And just to get a different flavor for, you know, war, For Whom the Bell Tolls, I read that during research, as well as Gone with the Wind. That there's a scene in it where, oh God, who told me this? Maybe it was Roscoe Mullins said that, you know, nurses, you know, were, there are some scenes where Scarlett O'Hara is a nurse to wounded soldiers. And there was a little bit in the book where that was very helpful in fleshing out a story that was told to me by Bob Smuts about nurses and on Hawaii. So that's about it for my current reading and what was helpful in researching the book.
I'd like to thank you for having been with us today.
Well, thank you, Boris. It's been a pleasure.
This has been the New Books Network. We thank you for listening to us.